From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The documentary Some Kind of Monster captures the metal band Metallica during a time of crisis. The band, on the verge of splitting up, starts group therapy, and then James Hetfield, the founder, storms out and enters rehab. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Hetfield. Some Kind of Monster is now out on DVD. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Million Dollar Baby, starring Clint Eastwood, Morgan Freeman, and Hilary Swank. And that's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, James Hetfield, the singer and guitarist with Metallica, the biggest-selling rock act of the 90s. The band has survived for over 23 years. As the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll says, after gaining a solid cult following among fans who could not identify with contemporary pretty boy pop metal combos such as Van Halen and Bon Jovi, Metallica became known for its sophisticated, often complex song structure and serious lyrics that reflected teen obsession with anger, despair, fear, and death. Some Kind of Monster, the acclaimed Metallica documentary, has just been released on DVD. Terry spoke with James Hetfield a few months ago about the time the film was in theaters. It chronicled the making of their album Saint Anger and the anger, tension, and exhaustion that nearly broke up the band as its members neared middle age. The band actually hired a therapist to conduct group therapy sessions. During this period, Hetfield checked himself into rehab. When he emerged, Metallica completed Saint Anger. Here's a song from it called Some Kind of Monster. These are the legs in circles run. This is the beating you'll never know. These are the lips that taste no freedom. This is the feel that's not so safe. This is the face you'll never change. This is the God that ain't so pure. This is the God that is not pure. This is the voice of silence no more. Some kind of monster. Some kind of monster. Some kind of monster. This monster lives.
James Hetfield, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start at the beginning of Metallica's history. What did you want Metallica to be?
Oh, boy. I wanted it to be freedom from school, from work, from the typical music that we were hearing. But really, it was music was somewhat of an escape for me that turned into a really great gift eventually. But it was a way to get away from my screwed up family.
What was screwed up about your family?
No one really communicated very well. It was very insular, very somewhat elitist in our religion. That's what they believe, but we believe this, which is better. You know, which is Christian Science. I grew up in that type of atmosphere. And I never really understood it either. So I felt very alienated from the outside world and from my family. So it was a connection, music for me was. But Metallica, when we hooked up, we were just passionate and loved music. And it was the soundtrack for our lives, you know, that it spoke for us.
And how old were you when the band started?
Let's see. Fresh out of high school, so 18 or 19, we started.
So no college?
No. We had college on the road, basically. Street college.
So you said that music was also an escape from work. Was this an escape from the work that you would have been doing had you not been in a band, or were you already working?
Well, I was working, and my dad left a note saying he was leaving at age 13. Never really said goodbye. My mom passed away at 16. I went and lived with my older brother, and she left some inheritance for me, but it was so tough to even want to touch that. It was like that was still mom. I didn't want to mess with that. So I went and I got a job working at a high school, moving a high school. Then it was custodial work. Then I went working in a factory because I had the long hair. That was pretty much all I could get. And, oh, it was so frustrating just sitting there. It was okay. I at lunch would go out and write in my truck, mm-hmm. write some songs. But I remember seeing this older guy working as the foreman. He one day you'll be foreman. Ooh, joy. Yeah. You know, and he's 40, 50 years old, and it's like, man, I cannot do this. I have to play music. It was in me. I knew it had to happen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Hetfield, one of the founders of Metallica, and there's a new Metallica book called So What? The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly. Now, I don't think you ever got into the kind of Spinal Tap type of show busy, you know, heavy metal stuff with the breastplates and the cod pieces. And, right. I mean, you never were into that, right?
Well, under my jeans.
Under your jeans, yes.
Well, we did some tours with bands.
You're more like T-shirts and jeans.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, we would walk on stage and play with what was comfortable, you know, wearing a spiked wristband with... with nails sticking out of it, you really couldn't wipe your forehead off with that, you know. It wasn't comfortable. You know, at the end of the day, we wanted to be, you know, just us. And, we had done some tours with bands. And growing up in L.A., it was kind of everywhere. And that was a little bit tried to sneak in, you know. I had bullet belts, you know, because Lemmy from Motorhead had that. That was the extent of our dressing up, you know. But you didn't really have to dress up and do things like that to be Spinal Tap. There are Spinal Tap moments that happen all the time.
Oh, tell me one. Tell me a great Spinal Tap moment.
Oh, landing in the wrong airport, you know, or, you know, saying the wrong city that you're in or something like that. Or, you know, there's always something that happens out there that people make fun of that and you're living it. And it's not so funny when it's going on, but... You know, those moments do happen.
Did you have your destructive period of destroying hotel rooms? And
oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. A lot of our early lyrics were all about that, you know. On the road, show up in a city, rape, pillage, move on, you know.
Now, what's your explanation for why you wanted to do that?
Oh, because I guess we could. Because I guess we were angry. We needed attention. And partly because you were supposed to, you know. We'd heard about, you know, the decadence of the 70s bands, you know, going in and they had orgies, they had, you know, they were throwing TVs out of, you know, you heard all those stories and we didn't really throw any TVs out of windows, but we jumped out of windows into pools, breaking bones, you know, setting off hotel alarms and at 4 a.m. and having to pay for everyone's room, you know, things like that, you know, kicking holes in walls, whatever, all kinds of just, you know, kind of releases. And after a while, it became a trap. You know, you're on tour paying for your destruction, you know, and you're not bringing any money home. So
did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy destroying things?
There was something about it. And it tied in with my anger a lot. And I had a lot of anger and rage problems that would just overcome me. And I would... Whatever was near, I'd throw it, and it would break. And it was just this adolescence that stuck with me, you know. And, you know, when I finally started, dating my wife-to-be, who is my wife now, Francesca, she, you know, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to myself and to her. And she helped me grow up quite a bit. But, yeah, there was something about smashing stuff that just felt right. It felt good.
Looking back, do you think it's a healthy thing to have the liberty of acting out rage in such a flamboyant public kind of way? And people, you know, a lot of fans really go for that because there's something so mythic about the guys who have the guts and the money to be able to, like, destroy things on a whim like that.
Well, I certainly don't think it's healthy. There's plenty of other ways to get your anger out. And I didn't know them. I didn't know those tools. My survival technique was... bottle up my anger because I couldn't talk about it. I was fearful of it. I was afraid that no one could relate to it. You know, already feeling like an outsider that if I told people this, they would just lock me up or something. So just keeping it bottled in and usually it took a bottle to get it out. I'd be drinking and then somehow something would smash or I'd hurt someone and... A lot of it was just a survival technique that I learned as a kid. I remember the first time that someone looked at me scared. When I was a kid, my mom, we had some friends over, and I was trying to hammer a nail into something, and it was too loose, and it wouldn't go in, and I had this hammer, and I kept smashing it. I was like maybe 6 years old, and my mom... said, Joey, that was my friend, said, come over here and stand by me. It's like, They think I'm dangerous. Maybe I am. That was the first time my mom looked at me really scared.
Was that empowering to you, or did it scare you about yourself?
It was both. It was a little both. Like, wow. Uh-huh. You know, now I've got something over her. But also, yeah, this gets attention, too.
James Hetfield, founder of the band Metallica, speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with James Hetfield, singer and guitarist of the band Metallica. The documentary about the group, Some Kind of Monster, is out on DVD. When we left off, Hetfield was talking about busting up hotel rooms and acting out feelings of anger that date back to his childhood.
Do you think that anger worked for you musically?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
I do now. Mm-hmm. At the time, we didn't analyze anything. It was just going for... it was going with the heart is what we called it, you know. It was whatever was coming out at the time. You know, I can't change what has happened, you know. Everything that has happened in our career, you know, as far as angry lyrics or whatever it was coming out subliminally even, that happened for a reason. It all happened for a reason for us to get where we are now, to realize, wow, that we were very... very immature in a way, but writing about it, you know, not knowing how to grow up or how to change your survival techniques or your tools in life, how to relate to people. And, you know, it took the band almost breaking up to realize a lot of things. And one was our form of expression and what a gift we have in that. And, you know, after getting clean and sober, going back and reading a lot of the lyrics, going, wow, that's pretty intense. And I can't believe there's some fans out there that really like this, you know?
Give me an example of what you're thinking.
Oh, well, something like A Dyer's Eve. This is a song about my parents and how they kept me in a cocoon, you know, not allowing me to see the world or what different religions there were or different kinds of people or, you know, for me, learning about other things was not... They were trying to keep me in almost like a cult type mm-hmm. of religion, mm-hmm. it felt like to me. And this song talks about, you know, now that you're gone, I'm out here in the world and lost, and I'm scared, and, you know, I blame you completely. And a lot of blame put onto my parents, you know, at that point. And it's pretty heavy stuff when I read it now. And, you know, but I realized my parents were doing the best they could with what they had to work with. You know, I didn't realize the trickle-down effect from their parents, you know. You know, you look at your parents as they're gods in a way, you know. They could never do wrong, you know. But looking back and realizing that, yeah, they made some mistakes, but they did the best they could. And let me sort out those mistakes and try and not repeat them.
Well, why don't we hear that song? This is Metallica.
Dear mother, dear father. What is this hell you have put me through? Believe a deceiver. Day in, day out, live my life through you. Pushed under me, what's wrong or right? Hidden from this thing that they call life. Dear mother, dear father. Every thought I think you disapproved. You're in a dictator. Always censoring my every move. Children are seeing that I'm not heard. Tear out.
That's Metallica, and my guest is one of the founders, James Hetfield, guitarist and vocalist. And there's, by the way, also a new Metallica book, which is called So What? So, okay, so that song speaks a bit about your parents. You know, your mother's dad, your father's still alive?
No, he's passed away. He passed away about 12 years ago or so.
Did you write this before he died, or?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What did he think when he heard it?
I don't know, and I really didn't care. Uh-huh. We didn't connect again for a long time.
Right.
And it was somewhat difficult trying to figure out, what is this relationship? What is it? Am I supposed to hate him still? You know, he's my dad. I love him, but dude, I mean, you screwed us over. You left, took all our money, enough that my mom couldn't survive, and she worried herself sick and eventually died and kind of was left hanging. And a lot of the stuff I was mad about was really him not teaching me how to be a man or a boy or whatever it was. And I had to figure it all out by myself, I felt, you know, and I wasn't ready for it. But I worked a lot of that anger out and some therapy things, which was really helpful. But yeah, you know, our relationship was very strange. After he left, it devastated me, you know. Well, he came back probably 6 months or to a year later, and he was, you know, he was midlife crisis dad, you know, had the stingray and the funky haircut. He shaved, and who's this guy, you know, bringing me gifts from Europe, you know, and Hawaii, and meanwhile we're struggling, you know.
Right.
And tried to shower us with, you know, gifts for love back, and I didn't take it. My sister instantly accepted him back, and I was not having it. So we had a strange relationship. Eventually got to be somewhat friends again, but it was never resolved. The stuff wasn't never resolved.
Was the music that you loved something you weren't supposed to listen to as far as your parents were concerned? Were there, like, religious reasons for not being supposed to listen to the music you love?
No. My mom was... It was quite bizarre. I see it in my marriage as well. Our you know, the opposites attract, you know. I'm somewhat of this, you know, kind of rebellious, unplanned character, and my wife is very organized, extremely moral, has a lot of that I was craving, and you know, we're a good balance. And in my parents, it was quite like that too, though. My dad was very strict, extremely strict, and mom was out there, very liberal, very, you know, she was letting us express our art, and so she really helped it along. She encouraged it. And Dad was kind of just, he didn't say much about it, you know.
The movie about Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, is an unusual kind of rock, you know, music documentary. It's not only the band, you know, kind of introspecting out loud about what's gone wrong with the band, about your relationships with each other. I mean, there's a therapist that you hire who usually works with sports teams, I think, to come in and talk with you and kind of help you all figure out what's going on and what you should do. Now that the movie has been out and a lot of people have seen it, a lot of your fans have seen it, they've seen a side of you and other members of the band that they probably didn't know. What has it changed in terms of, like, your public image or your relationship with your fans, how they see you?
Well, I sum it up as in, you get back whatever you put out. And I truly believe that. And, you know, a lot of times we're putting out some pretty negative stuff, very cynical, and we were getting that back. And now putting out some of our real fears, our vulnerabilities, our weaknesses, and putting them out there, and we're getting a lot of that back. We're getting people that relate to the human side and not just the fantasy side of, oh, he's up on stage, he's on a pedestal, he's an idol of sorts, and this and that. And
can you compare the difference?
Oh yeah.
In fan reactions?
Uh-huh. Yeah. But also I enjoy being a source of inspiration for the real me.
Right,
you know,
right.
There's no doubt about that. There was a lot of energy put into the on stage me, which, you know, I love that me too, and that's the me I kind of want to be. but I'm incorporating a lot of the real me up there, which is great. I can go up there and say, hey, everyone, how you doing? I feel like crap. And I'm feeling better now, though, that I'm up here. And just being real with the situation. And, man, that diffuses all kinds of fear and just anxiety about just being alive for me. But before the shows, we have something we call a meet and greet. And there's usually the fan club members that get picked out of a hat, or somehow they there's about 15 to 20 of them that come backstage before the show. And we actually get to talk with them, and it's amazing the different reactions we get. You know, there's your typical dude, you know, high-fiving guys, and then there's other people that are, you know, my dad struggled with alcohol, and I'm so glad, I'm proud of you for doing this, and they relate on different levels, and it's great to have access to all of that.
James Hetfield of the group Metallica. The documentary about the group, Some Kind of Monster, is out on DVD. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from The Dial Press, publisher of The Train to Lo Wu, a collection of stories set in Hong Kong by Jess Rowe. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the two versions of James Hetfield, before and after rehab. We continue our interview about his life with Metallica. And David Edelstein reviews the Clint Eastwood film Million Dollar Baby, based on the FX Tool story. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with James Hetfield, co-founder of Metallica. This metal band is still going strong after nearly 24 years together. A critically acclaimed documentary about the band, called Some Kind of Monster, has just been released on DVD. And a Metallica scrapbook called So What? The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly has recently been published. When we left off, James Hetfield was talking about who he really is versus the onstage version of himself, and how fans related to him after the more vulnerable side of the band was revealed in the documentary.
You know what I find interesting? Like, the kind of fan who relates to, like, the persona that you created, like the mythic version of yourself, the onstage version of yourself. And they're trying to model themselves on somebody who you're not even. Do you know what I mean? It's like, this is something like you created. It works really well on stage, but it's not what you are off stage. And they're trying to be that onstage person.
Yeah, it is. It is quite a strange cycle. And, you know, for me, there are parts of me on the stage that are certainly me. There's somewhat of a hat or jacket that you put on to go up and perform. We're performers.
Yeah, yeah.
But with a real heart. And, you know, it's all really about the music. But when fans come to see you play, they want to see something. They you can't just stand there and play. You could, but it's not as entertaining as running around or showing on your face some of the anger of a song or some of the sadness on a song or some of the thing. It is performing. And then when they meet you at the airport, you're waiting for your bags and, you know, they come up to you, hi, how's it going? And you're, you know, kind of tired from a flight and you're shaking hands and they're like, wow, you're not what I thought you were. And instantly, it's like, why do I feel depressed about that, you know? So you think I should jump on the turn wheel and like smash some bags or what should I do, you know? And I'm not going to do that, you know. It's, you know, yeah, this is me and maybe I'm in a crabby mood, so go away or, you know, whatever it may be. Or, hey, I'm in a great mood, come over here, let's take a picture. And, you know, it's subjective to moods at times. But when people get disappointed for meeting you, that's so strange. But I've owned what part is mine and what is theirs, because, you know, they've got something built up in their head that they need for their life.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not that they meet, they're disappointed in what they've built up for themselves. And sometimes that's a tough reality check. And, you know, so I leave that with them, but I also am nice and say, hey, you know, this is another part of me. And yeah, like you mentioned in this movie, this is the extreme other part of us. There's the giant, mighty Metallica, indestructible on stage, and then there's this broken, lost, confused, fighting, struggling Metallica.
And there's two different James Hetfields in the movie, too. There's the pre-rehab and post-rehab version of you.
Prehab.
Prehab, yeah.
But well, I like to reside in the middle somewhere. That's the challenge, you know, somewhere in the middle. Because that movie was... it just captured us at such a time, and what a great gift the movie was. Not scripted. We had no idea that was going to happen. We're rolling cameras, and you know, things start happening.
You're talking about when you walked out?
Well, any of that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They were filming us making the record, and then some. The all of our shells started cracking, and inner stuff from childhood and everything started coming out in front of the cameras, and we did not care who was there or what was there. It was flowing, and it felt right.
Why didn't you care? Why weren't you self-conscious about this being recorded?
Oh, I was. There's plenty of parts in the movie where I'm just saying, get this camera out of here. You know, why is this? And I felt that it was hindering my recovery, you know, but I had to check it out, you know. I'm really glad it was all filmed, because that's one of the best gifts that I could have in my life, to go back and visit some of that. See yourself in a completely childish moment or a really articulate moment, mm-hmm, or a scared moment, you're crying or whatever it is, seeing yourself on film, but having the other people around you and going to a theater, watch people reacting to you doing that.
Right.
Like, wow.
James Hetfield speaking with Terry Gross. Let's hear a clip from the Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster. The band is listening back to one of their rehearsal tapes. Hetfield doesn't like what the drummer, Lars Ulrich, is playing. Ulrich isn't very enthusiastic about Hetfield's guitar playing. It hasn't been a good day.
Just real confusing sound.
It's just jacking the vocals all up. I mean, it's clever and everything, but... I don't see what it does to it.
I think that's how you hear it, dude. I mean, that's fine. I'm just trying to do something different.
I mean, I'm used to having the drummer do the beat part. You know what I mean? Holding it together.
What I'm hearing is... Let me choose my words carefully here. it's pretty straightforward. You know, the guitar shit, it's, you know, it's a little stock. So I started trying to introduce some kind of edge to it from the drums.
Those things we throw out to each other are complete bullshit. You know, it sounds too stock. It sounds too normal to me. That, I mean, you know what I mean? You're saying this shit so you can get your point across about doing a drum beat. I mean, you know, it doesn't hold any water.
To you.
It doesn't.
I think it's f***ing stock. What? Which part of that is unclear to you? I think it sounds stock to my ears. I mean, you want me to write it down? I think
I
feel stock,
I
okay?
Can't hear you.
So I...
No, when you say, you're telling me what to play right now. You're telling me you should play with what Kirk's doing, and I'm telling you it's stock.
Dude, fine.
You know what, guys? Why don't we just go in there and just hammer it out, all right, instead of hammering on each other?
This is so silly. You're just sitting there going, I'm in a really pissy mood, and you're just sitting here being a complete
You're really helping matters. You're really good at that. I was straight up with you, and I told you I'm in a shit mood, and what have you been doing? Picking at me all night.
Come on, guys. We've got better things to do.
Yeah, I do. I do.
So this moment in the documentary, you're really angry. You walk out, and then you're going to rehab, and you don't come back for 11 months later. When you walked out of the room, did you know that you were headed to rehab after that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's somewhat deceiving in the movie that, you know, I slammed that door. You know, Bob came out and we had a talk. You know, eventually I came back another time and I talked about how things weren't going well at home, how I'd got thrown out of the house. And a lot of that revolved around that and how things in the band weren't going well or at home. And just, wow, how lost I felt. My whole world was shaking under me. You know, all of the roots, the foundations that I felt I had in my life. And, I came back and I talked to them that, hey, I've you know, after so-and-so date, I have to go away. I have to work on myself.
Right.
And they knew I couldn't just leave. You know, that was not right. But it was discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And I told
mm-hmm.
them, you know, I don't know how long it's going to be, and I don't know. You're going to have to trust me on this. I just know I have to go and just, you know, I have to rebuild my life. I have to strip down. I had no idea what was in store for me, really. But I knew I had to get some help.
Were you like a star in the rehab unit?
That was the hugest fear out of everything.
What, that you'd be or that you'd not be?
That I would be.
Mm-hmm.
That, it's so silly now to think about it. But at that time, you know, for me, the biggest fear was, you know, I had tried therapy before and to stop drinking and my just destructive behaviors. I wasn't really ready for it. And I thought, well, that doesn't really work for me. And then check, you know, my wife says, you got to check yourself in somewhere. You got to go to a hospital or a rehab or something. It's like, no way. Don't you know who I am, kind of thing? You know, I wouldn't get real treatment there. You know, I couldn't do that. And my fear was that I couldn't. There was no help for me. And I was, of course, creating that fear for myself to continue my behavior, you know. But when I went there, I checked in under a different name, did all that stuff, you know, had the tag on that said, hi, my name is Frank, blah, blah, whatever it was. And at the first meeting they had in there, people went around the room saying their names and what, you know, was going on in their lives. And I just said, you know what, my name's James and I got a fake tag on and this is crap and I'm here to get some help and I'm fearful of this and this and this. And I broke down crying and I told people my fears and man, they were just right behind me saying, don't worry about it. You know, you're human. We're all humans in here struggling. And that right then I knew I was in the right place.
James Hetfield, singer and guitarist of the band Metallica, speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with James Hetfield, singer and guitarist of the band Metallica.
Whose idea in the band was it to actually hire a therapist and have the band work through its issues like a couple might go to a marriage counselor?
It pretty much is a marriage counselor. Well, Mr. Toll, he was a therapist. He didn't have a therapist license. He was an enhancement coach, which was, you know, another form of, you know, attitude adjustment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But basically that told us that he could give feedback, you know, and eventually it was tough to kind of find the boundary of friend and, you know, whatever, hired coach.
Mm-hmm.
But he came on board when our management Q Prime called and said, "What do you think about this?" You know, he's worked with another one of our acts, and we got to get talking, you know, because that was the big deal. There was no communication, you know, over the years of this machine of Metallica rolling on. We discovered that, say, a band like a Guns N' Roses, they're in each other's face. They're very vocal about their attitudes, their thinking, their feelings. We said, we can't do that, you know. Look at them, and they eventually break up. So we're not going to do that. So we shut up for years and years and years. And that was self-destructive as well. We had to communicate. So we got this guy, Phil Toll, to come in. He was like a mediator in a way. He kind of made the room safe, neutralized the room. So he helped us talk to each other because there was a lot of diffusing of bombs in the early days. So much baggage, tons, heavy stuff from years and years, a resentment that had just crushed our creativity and our friendships.
Some of the resentment was directed at you for being, you know, too controlling and mm-hmm. For not allowing other people's creativity to surface in the way that yours mm-hmm. could in the band. Was that news to you? Were you aware of those feelings before?
No, not really. You know, being the controlling person, I thought I was just doing what I was supposed to do. But really, it was a lot of insecurity, you know. I'm afraid that if I'm not the creative guy, what use am I here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that had a lot to do with me, me projecting that onto other people. You know, why are you here? You know, if you don't serve a purpose, see you later. You know, it's kind of the radar, the fame radar goes up, you know. You know. Are you a friend of mine? No. What do you got to offer? Go away. You know, that kind of attitude. And I was putting that out myself. So I was afraid that if I wasn't creative, I'd be gone.
Was there something that the therapist actually helped you understand about the relationship of the members of the band that you don't think would have emerged without him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when he brought up the word ego, I looked at Lars, he looked at me, you know, and then we had to look at each other, ourselves, you know, right. We had to look in the mirror. It's like, okay, yeah, all right, I'll own a little bit of that. And eventually it's like, yeah, you know what, we've both driven each other to certain just egotistical giants, you know, and thank God Kirk, you know, was such the referee through life, you know. And Jason obviously didn't fit in because he was like the minor ego, you know, and it was out of balance, you know, it seemed like. But yeah, that was a shock somewhat. And yeah, you know, I brought up the words, you know, ogre or intimidator, you know, and how I hated being that person. I want to have friends. Why don't I have friends? And they're telling me, well, you're like this. It's like, well, no, I'm not. I don't want to be that. How do I not be that? And that's when I realized that was a tool I brought with me since childhood, you know, intimidate. Man, my dad was pretty darn good at that. He just shoot a look, and that was all. That's all you needed to know. And that, you know, it was such a great tool to not have to get to know people, you know. I didn't have to get friendly with anyone. Intimacy was so scary. And it still is, you know. It gets so close to someone, what if they leave? I would be crushed, you know. It's like the amount of love that you give is, to me, equated the amount of hurt when they left, you know, and it's still, I still struggle with that.
So when you're on stage now, do you feel like you have a different stage persona than you did in the era before the movie, before Rehab?
Definitely.
What's different?
Well, touring itself is different. There's a mission, and that mission is that 2.5 hours on the stage and meeting people beforehand. But as far as being on the stage and being able to look people in the eye and feel like, you know, we're equal, I don't have any shame about all the behavior I've been doing out here. I'm clean with that. We're here to express some joy for life. And we are here. We're alive. We're able to yell and scream and connect through lyrics. And you're not alone. and I feel that too. And it's really great to be able to get up there. And that's the part I'm going to miss most, being off the road. It's almost like a drug in a way.
But being on the road is like a drug?
Well, being on the stage and getting that feeling of being loved, you know? And obviously I have people at home that love me, but there's something that's there. There's something that's just intoxicating on the stage that you can change people's attitudes, you know? You can make them smile up there, and it's so cool. It was never like that before, never.
I want to read you something. This is from the BBC news service, and it's headlined, "Heavy metal music and popular American children's songs are being used by U.S. interrogators to break the will of their captives in Iraq." Okay, so let me read some more. "Uncooperative prisoners are being exposed for prolonged periods to tracks by rock group Metallica and music from children's TV programs Sesame Street and Barney in the hope of making them talk. The U.S.'s psychological operations company said the aim was to break a prisoner's resistance through sleep deprivation and playing music that was culturally offensive to them. Sergeant Mark Hatzel of psychological operations told Newsweek magazine, "These people haven't heard heavy metal. They can't take it. If you play it for 24 hours, your brain and body functions start to slide. Your train of thought slows down and your will is broken. That's when we come in and talk to them." Our producer, Amy Salad, found this, and I had to read it to you. What do you think hearing that?
Yeah, there's many things that go through my mind. First of all, I mean, I want to make light of it, you know, instantly like, we have nothing to do with the war and all of this. And I was like, I don't have to defend that. You know, we make our music. It goes out there. Whatever's done with it is kind of done with it. We have no control over that. There's another part of me that wants to joke about it that says, we've been punishing our parents, our wives, our loved ones with this music forever. Why should the Iraqis or whoever it is be any different? And also, there's a pride also that, you know, it's culturally offensive to them, freedom, you know. The lyrics, for me, are a form of expression and a freedom to express my insanity. And boy, if they're not used to freedom, I'm glad to be a part of the exposure. But I really know the reason is the relentlessness of the music. It's completely relentless. And to break someone that's not used to that, yeah. I mean, if I listen to like a death metal band, you know, for 12 hours in a row, I'd go insane. I'd tell you anything you wanted to know, you know? So.
Well, obviously they didn't ask you for your permission.
No,
not that I'd expect them to.
No, I wouldn't either. But you know, Sesame Street can be pretty annoying
yeah,
too.
Yeah, can you imagine Barney and Metallica? What?
Awesome. Well, there's our next tour. There you go. In Iraq. That'd be awesome.
James Hetfield, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
James Hetfield, co-founder of Metallica, speaking with Terry Gross last November. A scrapbook about the band called So What? The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly has recently been published, and the documentary about the band, Some Kind of Monster, has been released on DVD. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new Clint Eastwood film, Million Dollar Baby. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Clint Eastwood's new film Million Dollar Baby, based on stories by the late FX Tool, was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Director, Actor, Actress, and Supporting Actor. Opening this week across the country, the movie has already provoked strong reactions, both positive and negative, among critics and audiences. Our critic, David Edelstein, has these thoughts.
Okay, sports fans. The bookies say Clint Eastwood's Million Dollar Baby is closing in on Martin Scorsese's The Aviator as the Oscar frontrunner. Although the movie has been playing in major cities for over a month, it's only now opening across the country. And given all the critics' prizes and the nominations, it's worth reviewing at this late date, especially since I think it's an extremely artful exercise in obviousness. There's a dilemma for critics in discussing Million Dollar Baby because the meaning hinges on plot turns that shouldn't be spoiled. So when I get to that part, you'll hear a spoiler bell. And if you haven't seen the film, you'll have a few seconds to turn the volume down. I'll ring it again when it's time to come back. Now, I should admit, I'm an Eastwood skeptic. Some critics consider him an old master, or as the New York Film Festival program put it, on par with Hemingway and Shakespeare. His vision is certainly consistent. His movies convey a tragic inevitability, and he's become a real actor. That voice, once barely inflected, good largely for sneering at degenerates before blowing them away, is now a painful rasp that can barely contain its emotion. As a screen icon, Eastwood has real gravitas, but I'm not sold on his directorial gravitas. His style is a unique combination of the laid-back and the drop an anvil on your head. In Million Dollar Baby, Eastwood plays Frankie Dunn, an aging boxing trainer. Frankie is tortured. He has premonitions of doom, perhaps the result of once letting Eddie Scrap Iron Dupree, played by Morgan Freeman, stay in the ring too long. Old Eddie is now the manager janitor of Frankie's rundown gym. He's also the film's narrator, making pronouncements like, "Boxing is about respect, getting it for yourself, and taking it away from the other guy." Frankie protects his fighters to the point of jeopardizing their careers, which leaves him underoccupied when the dirt-poor but plucky Maggie Fitzgerald, played by Hilary Swank, shows up and begs to be trained. But surly Frankie wants no part of women's boxing.
I'll warm up the car.
Mr. Dunn.
I owe you money.
No, sir.
I know your mama.
Don't rightly know, sir.
What is it you want?
I was on the undercard. I won my fight, too. Maggie Fitzgerald?
Well, Maggie Fitzgerald, what's up?
Did you happen to see it?
Nope.
I did pretty good. Thought you might be interested in training me.
I don't train girls.
Maybe you should. People see me fight, say I'm pretty tough.
Girly, tough ain't enough.
Frankie is ultimately struck by her pluck. And after the obligatory training montage, she wins big. Maggie charges onto the canvas, shining-eyed, lit from within, and lays her opponents flat. But Frankie won't let her go for the title. He has a gut feeling about his fighters' destinies. Eastwood has suffused Million Dollar Baby with his usual gloom, with people discovered in pools of light amid oppressive darkness. The boxing scenes are tight and fast, with the camera in the ring. Here's where you want to turn your radio down. You can see Maggie's tragic martyrdom limping toward you, but you can't quite believe this cliched go-for-it boxing picture would sucker punch you with tragedy so extreme. Maggie ultimately compares herself to a dog that needs to be shot, and the movie agrees. That weirdly belligerent priest doesn't, but the true spiritual conscience, Eddie, gives Frankie his blessings to finish her off. Isn't it strange this million-dollar baby has no visits from fans, no flowers, no one but Frankie to care about her fate? Her trailer trash family is so cartoonishly venal that they practically have dollar signs superimposed over their eyes. Last year, Christopher Reeve went out like a champ, but Eastwood's movie is so threadbare, underpopulated, and shameless that there really is nothing for Maggie to live for. Now it's okay to listen again. People make the case that Million Dollar Baby is an allegory with boxing as its frame, but I can't get past all the wrong and crudely manipulative notes on the surface. Images do linger, especially Eastwood, Freeman's watchful gaze, Swank's determined smile, But Maggie is a phony construct, an innocent whose saintliness doesn't track with her aggression in the ring. Richard Schickel, in his hagiography, compares Eastwood's films to modern jazz and says he has, quote, a powerful desire almost amounting to a morality not to woo the audience. Morality? As Dirty Harry tells the bad guys, a man's got to know his limitations. Eastwood is shrewd at making his look like bold artistic choices.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of the book French Women Don't Get Fat by Mireille Giuliano. And from Sundance Channel, presenting Festival Dailies, nightly coverage of the 2005 Sundance Film Festival hosted by Jay Moore, tonight at 9 Eastern and Pacific. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the new novel, Pearl, a mother struggles to understand her daughter's public act of martyrdom. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with author Mary Gordon. One reviewer describes Pearl as brave, powerful, and moving, full of suspense and humanity. Join us for the next Fresh Air. In the new novel, Pearl, a mother struggles to understand her daughter's public act of martyrdom. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with author Mary Gordon. One reviewer describes Pearl as brave, powerful, and moving, full of suspense and humanity. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.